Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Is there anything about our climate future that makes you feel optimistic?
I feel like there are some people who are going towards it, but there's still some stuff going on, so I'm like split. I'm not sure that they'll actually save it in time, but they also could.
I feel really unoptimistic. Ever since I was really young, I was scared about climate change. I don't necessarily feel like enough is being done to change that.
I kind of feel better about it, especially younger people, I think, are talking about it more. With more like importance.
With COVID, everybody who could do anything about it was doing it, but with this we have like 6 years and no one's doing anything.
Do you hope something happens by the time you're an adult?
Yes, I do.
Do you think it will?
Maybe and maybe not.
It's Notes from America. I'm Kai Wright, and welcome to the show. This week, we're going to revisit a conversation about the climate that we had in August of 2023. When we first aired this discussion, we were dealing with a cascade of climate disasters in the U.S. Maui was reeling from the deadliest wildfire in U.S. history. Hundreds were killed and thousands were displaced. And around the country, from New York to Washington, the air was dangerously filled with smoke from fires raging in Canada. That's before you get to the flooding and the fact that 2023 was the hottest year on record around the world. But it's only going to get hotter this year. And as we continue to grapple with the fallout of these climate disasters, we're also going into an election year, not just in the U.S. Voters in more than 60 countries will go to the polls in 2024. That's more than half of the world's population. Will climate change be as central to the conversation as it needs to be for us to survive at this point? But here's the thing. It's very easy to take all of what I just said and feel like our fate is sealed. And there is increasing concern among climate activists and experts that fatalism about the climate is as much of an impediment to action as denial has been in the past. So in this conversation, we focus on potential solutions. Coming up, we're going to meet some people who share stories of what they consider to be progress in their communities, contributions they have made to both fixing our climate and adapting to the reality in which we live. First up is Ricky Held. She's a 22-year-old native of Broadus, Montana, and the lead plaintiff in the historic lawsuit Held v. Montana, which made headlines last summer. Ricky and 15 co-plaintiffs, all between the ages of 5 and 22, sued the state for violating their right to a clean and healthful environment, which is a right enshrined in the Montana State Constitution. A judge ruled in their favor, and the ruling was called by some one of the strongest ever on climate change. Similar lawsuits have been filed, but this is the first case of its nature to go to trial, let alone to win. So here's my conversation with Ricky from a few days after her legal victory. Thanks for this time, Ricky.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so your testimony as lead plaintiff was about your family farm. So first off, just kind of tell us about that farm and, you know, try to make us all understand where you grew up and what that place meant to your family or means to your family.
Yeah. I grew up in southeastern Montana. Near Broadus, like you said, and my family had, we have a ranch and motels in town. And so just growing up out there was amazing. And I'm right here right now. and just being really part of the ranching operations. And even when I was four, like out moving cattle horseback and being able to jump in the river or climb trees or like take care of barnyard animals. So it's wonderful being from here.
So it's a cattle ranch for those of us not from Montana or from such areas. That's the idea, is this great big space where cattle are roaming. The Powder River runs through the ranch. You testified about a series of floods and droughts as the lead plaintiff in the case. The river is both your water source for the ranch and a threat when it floods. Can you explain what you told the court about how those events affected your family?
Yeah. Being a plaintiff in this case, I've gotten to tell my personal story, and that includes more water variability. That includes the Powder River is dried up 1 year enough to stop flowing, and it's also flooded. Especially when there's higher than normal temperatures in like winter, early spring, and then a bunch of ice melts and there's flooding, and that's undercut our banks and undercut fences. And we do rely on water, and so we rely on snowpack and hills, but that's not lasting into the summer. With wildfires, both directly and indirectly, sometimes they'll burn down power lines. Like we had this one time where 70 miles of power lines were burned down. And so that affected our ability to get water up to our tanks in the hills to our cattle. And with drought, there's less grass. Cattle have to travel farther. So it all kind of works together in the system. And especially being from a ranch community, we rely on the land so much for our livestock and our crops and, and just our livelihood. So yeah, you can really see those impacts.
And what are the consequences? I mean, for that, the flooding and the wildfires that you're describing, what are the consequences for the ranch when that happens?
I mean, at one level, it's your home and that's your whole life. And at another, it's just, I mean, the basic financial and economic losses. And ranching is hard anyway. And then facing all of these changes and unstable climate system, it just furthers that. And, you know, sometimes summers are just so smoky all the time and get air quality alerts and are having extreme heat days. And you just have to keep working through that. And with our motels in town, that's affected by like the Yellowstone flooding that closed down highways, or less wildlife that affects our hunting season reservations. So it all kind of works together.
An interesting factoid about you that I learned reading about you was that you have been an environmental scientist since you were 15 years old. You participated in a long-term study of the Powder River. Since it runs through your property, you helped take measurements for the study, and you are cited in a journal article on this river, which is really cool. But I also read that as you were learning about climate change in that age, in high school, you didn't think it affected you personally because you didn't live near an ocean. Tell me about that and what made you think differently about it.
Right. Yeah. When I was in high school and I first learned about climate change, it kind of sort of seemed like this thing on the other side of the world that was affecting like glaciers, polar bears, and sea level rise. And I thought it was a huge issue even then, but I guess I just learned more, did my own research, started connecting what I was seeing on the ranch to this very real issue, and I made it a lot more personal. And I've through this case, I've been able to tell my personal story and understand it inside of this like more broad global narrative. But everyone is impacted by climate change, and sometimes it's hard to think about it that way. But I mean, even with the wildfire smoke, like all you guys there were affected by the smoke and from Canada this year, and we're all affected because our societies depend on these stable environments.
Right. The lawsuit was possible because of an amendment to the state constitution from the 1970s that says Montana residents have a right to a clean and healthful environment. Before the lawsuit, were you aware that you had that constitutional right?
No. I remember jumping on the first call with OCT, our Children's Trust, after I reached out to them, and they explained what the lawsuit was and that we had rights in our constitution, such as to a clean, healthful environment, besides all the rights to life and liberty and land and all that. And I just thought it was a perfect case because of those rights protected by generations before us. And, you know, in that 1972 Constitutional Convention, people from all over the state were there, and ranchers, educators, clergy, and lawyers and businessmen, like, they all came together to protect those rights because mm-hmm. we care about our land and our people. And so I guess with this case, we're kind of trying to continue that mm-hmm. as the future generation to protect it for now and future ones ahead.
A lot has been made of your youth, the fact that you're all youth in this lawsuit and other lawsuits. Why is your age relevant to the conversation? Why does it matter that you are young people fighting for this right to you?
Yeah. Well, youth are disproportionately affected by climate change. We had experts in our court case testify to that with physical health, for one, you know, more likely to be affected by air pollution and extreme heat, for some examples. And then youth don't have a say in our government systems, can't vote, and aren't in positions of power. And so I was 18 when we filed this case, and so I've been lucky that I've been able to vote now and have more of a say. But we really are doing this case because young people don't have voices and future generations don't have voices. And we need the courts to protect those rights and our governments to take responsibility and do what's best for its citizens.
We're listening back to a conversation I had with Ricky Held, a 22-year-old environmental scientist from Broadus, Montana. She's the lead plaintiff in Held v. Montana, a case brought by her and 15 other young people working with the legal group Our Children's Trust. On August 14, 2023, a district court ruled that the state had in fact violated Ricky's right to a clean and healthful environment. Coming up, we'll talk a little bit more about the case and hear from some of our listeners about what they see as victory in the fight against climate change in their communities. We're not going to take live calls this week, but if you do want to share a story of a climate victory in your community, we'd still love to hear from you. This is a topic we will return to soon, and your story might even inspire an episode of its own. So if you want to talk, just make a voice recording on your phone and email it to us at notes@wnyc.org. That's notes@wnyc.org. Stay with us.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Notes from America. I'm Kai Wright. Welcome back. Before we return to our conversation about climate action, I want to draw your attention to the first in a series of conversations that we'll be having about the 2024 presidential election. Donald Trump emerged as the winner of the Iowa Republican caucus, making it all the more likely he will be the party's candidate for president again. And I'm really curious to hear from people who consider themselves conservative but are facing yet another election in which they don't feel represented as voters. So if you are conservative, but Donald Trump is decidedly not your candidate, where are you focusing your political energy this year? How do you see yourself fitting into the political landscape? We'd love to hear from you, particularly if you identify as a person of color who is conservative, or if you're from an immigrant household. The easiest way to talk to us is to record a voice memo on your phone and email it to us at notes@wnyc.org. That's notes@wnyc.org. Okay, back to my 2023 conversation with Ricky Held, a 22-year-old environmental scientist who won a landmark legal case against her home state of Montana late last year. And Ricky, I want to ask you about the state's response to your victory. The state attorney general's office is appealing the ruling and has called your suit a publicity stunt. They note that similar cases have been dismissed from state and federal courts, and they're confident they'll win on appeal to the state Supreme Court. How do you respond to that criticism that this is a publicity stunt?
I don't know. I guess I just know that this is the right thing to do because the state of Montana has known about climate change, human-caused climate change, since the 1960s, and we have technologies to switch to more renewable energy sources that would protect our state and beyond Montana as well. And it would reduce electricity costs and health costs because people are being affected. So I don't know how you can argue, but we presented a week of evidence and the state had their chance to do that. And they presented for part of a day. And you just can't argue with what our experts testified to because we had such a strong story with all the personal plaintiff testimony and with our experts talking about the science, the best available science we have on the climate science and what the impacts are to youth, especially with health and mental health impacts and all of the opportunities we have moving forward and that Montana can rely on, like wind, water, and solar, and how much it would benefit our state. So no, it's not a publicity stunt. This is coming out of our Montana values and our laws and our constitution.
And how do you, where do you fall on this realm of optimism versus doom and gloom and fatalism around climate change? This suit is an act of great optimism, so I think I know. But for those of us that we're going to spend the rest of this show talking about, like, how do we feel about climate change and what does it mean for how we then act? What would you say to folks who are feeling fatalistic about it?
Well, how I feel about it is terrifying. And sometimes when you let it all kind of rush in and think about it, like I think about all of the things that you hear on the news all the time, and it just is still happening and we're in the midst of this crisis and we do need to do something about it. But sometimes it's good to let that fear sink in and realize that this is a problem, but that isn't going to help us move forward. And so we just need to think about actionable steps that we can take moving forward. And this case was a great example of that. It's the first time that a court has declared state fossil fuel policies unconstitutional. And there's going to be other cases going forward. And just there are actions that we can take as individuals or states or at a more global national scale that we need to take because this is the world we live in and we want to protect it. And so it is good to stay optimistic, and I am, and I have a lot of hope for a future, especially taking action and working with so many amazing people who are looking out for a future. That's what gives me hope.
Ricky Held is the lead plaintiff in Held v. Montana, a case brought by her and 15 other young people working with the legal advocacy group Our Children's Trust that sued the state of Montana for violating their right to a clean and healthful environment on August 14th. A district court ruled that the state had, in fact, violated Ricky's rights. Ricky, thank you so much for this time.
Thank you so much.
And I have been asking for you to call in with your stories of other kinds of climate progress in your community. You have certainly responded. There are a great many of you on the phone. So I'm going to just start taking a few of them now. And in a minute, we will be joined by Liza Featherstone, who has written an article in the New Republic that is helping us think through this tension between optimism and fatalism as well. But let's start with Carrie Ann in Chicago, Illinois. Carrie, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So do you have a story of climate victory in your community, Carrie?
Yeah. So when I was in college in upstate New York, I organized with a bunch of other students on my campus, and we pushed the college to join an international accord. And the whole point of all of it was to talk about climate change in every single classroom, regardless of the content area. And so we were successful. Our college joined the accord, and what that wound up looking like in our community is for our college campus, we started talking about climate change in studio arts and in writing and in gender studies classes. And we started to build a more intersectional understanding of the solutions that exist and also the way we're approaching solutions and how lots of different roles in our community can help develop and bring in support for creating a resilient future together. And it was really cool because even though we had only passed it at the college level, we were in such a localized community. A lot of the effects of starting to talk about climate change at that level made its way into high school classes. And then also just like there was a boom of work happening in the community all of a sudden where we were doing all types of cool stuff to help fight or mitigate climate change's effects for our local community.
Wow. So it was catalytic. You took one action. It had an advance. It had a victory, and that led to more action.
Yeah. And I think like when we talk about how to build hope, it was like we were really loud about we want to talk about it. And it was catalytic because we were talking loud enough, and that gave our community enough hope to be like, oh, we can actually do some of this stuff.
Thank you for that, Carrie. Let's go to Scott in Longford, Connecticut. Scott, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
What's your climate victory story you want to share, Scott?
Well, it's kind of related to climate change, and it's also related to globalization. But here in Connecticut, we have the wonderful Connecticut River that runs all the way from practically Canada down through New Hampshire and Vermont, Massachusetts, and Connecticut. And we're lucky down in southern Connecticut to have the Connecticut River as a tidal estuary. It's one of the most productive and untampered with river systems on the whole East Coast. And unfortunately, several large river systems on the East and New England, et cetera, have been hammered by an invasive aquatic plant called water chestnut. It comes from Asia, and that's the globalization part, how that was brought in. But also with water temperatures warming and water levels rising, it's spreading. So we've got a bunch of us for several years who have been out harvesting this harmful plant. It puts out these crazy seeds that are like the size of a walnut with these sharp thorns on them, really big. They would puncture a tire if a car rode over it, or certainly a water shoe or sandal, et cetera. They're really bad. Each seed can generate 8 or so florets of plants, and each one of those florets will put out about 8 more seeds. So unchecked, they really go crazy. Done a lot of damage in the Hudson River system. And we've been harvesting. Yeah, go ahead.
And so you've been harvesting them, cleaning them out. And I have to say that it outstrips my understanding a little bit, Scott, but the point is that there is an invasive thing, and you've been able to get it out of the environment, right? Thank you.
We're getting out there in small boats. We have to lean over the side of the boat, haul that stuff in with our hands. It's dirty. It's ugly. Okay. Then you have to fill the boat up with it and go get rid of it. Sometimes we have some assistance with trucks, but, it's a lot of hard work, but we're making the river a better place. We call ourselves unsung heroes.
Well, now you are a sung hero, Scott. We have sung you on the radio nationally, taking care of your local river. Thank you, Scott. As we continue to take your calls, I'm going to be joined now by activist and author Liza Featherstone, who wrote an essay for The New Republic earlier this summer that really got my attention, in which she argued, quote, "The case against both climate hope and climate despair." That was the headline of the essay. And she joins me to explain what exactly she wants us to feel if it's neither hope nor despair. Hi, Liza. Thanks for this time.
Hi, Kai. Thanks for having me. And I should say, you know, usually writers say, oh, yeah, I don't write the headlines, but I actually did write that headline, that so
your,
I have to own that.
That was your work.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, well, first off, anything that you heard in either Carrie or Scott there that you want to respond to in terms of how we're feeling about climate change right now?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I think this is just so generative because we rarely ask people, you know, we rarely ask the general public, what is a climate victory in your community or something that you've been a part of? And just after a couple minutes, we're hearing the most amazing stories. And it definitely, I think, reflects how little of that is picked up normally in the media, for some good reasons and for some bad reasons. Yeah. You know that we kind of tend to focus on the worst disasters that are happening because they are very newsworthy and important. but then that piece of like people are winning and doing something about this every day. And when we lose track of that, it's like, well, no wonder so many people are suffering from climate despair and climate anxiety. And I guess the case against both is, the case against what many in the climate movement are calling doomism. Doomism is the sense that there is nothing we can do. The fix is in. The climate apocalypse is coming. I think that that's a narrative that's been criticized for a long time, and kind of gained some respectability a few years ago with Jonathan Franzen and some other literary guys who started writing these essays about, how, they were just giving up. And, those arguments were widely criticized by scientists, climate scientists, who argue absolutely not. There's a lot that we can do and are doing about this problem. But the affect is very contagious and pervasive and very understandable because we are seeing just almost a daily, loss of life from some climate disaster or another, and it's devastating. The case against climate hope, I mean, what I mean by that is, there's a writer named Mary Louise Hegler has a great term, hopium, which is, the sort of way that when faced with a serious problem, hope can be just, kind of anesthetizing, as the climate movement wants to, motivate people, get their attention, how serious this problem is. A lot of the sort of positivity and especially coming out of the tech world, we can solve this, we can do anything, can have an anesthetizing effect. And what we really want to see, I think, as a climate movement and as members of the human race is a realistic approach, which is, recognizing our feelings of grief and anxiety are very valid, that, this situation is extremely serious, but that recognition should motivate us to take action, like all the great people that you just talked with, and that taking action isn't just kind of an existential Sisyphean thing that we do to make ourselves feel a little better. Taking action is actually really working. Yeah. Not that we can stop the worst effects of climate change. Those are already here. But we can save many of our civilizations. We can save many lives. We can save many ecosystems and many species. And we are doing that. Yeah. So, it's a balance. Our feelings need to lead us to this balance.
To this balance. But yeah. You argue in the piece, and give me the thumbnail version of this in just like, maybe a minute or so, that we've made more progress in the last couple, of years that were unimaginable in the recent past.
Completely.
Make that case
yeah.
In 60 seconds.
Completely. I mean, you know, in past even democratic administrations, you know, if we got a regulation that saved a species or two, we'd be like, the environmental movement would be like, yay, this is an amazing victory. I mean, we have seen the Inflation Reduction Act, which and also the Bipartisan Infrastructure Acts, which invested billions and billions of federal money into decarbonizing our economy. We're going to be seeing the effects of that more and more as that comes online. And, you know, New York State just won a significant, we just won a significant victory in the Build Public Renewables Act to use public money. And actually, that builds on the victory of getting so much investment from the Inflation Reduction Act, because we can use that money to build public renewables in New York State. And it creates a blueprint that other states can use as well. And I would say these are the kinds of things that that really couldn't have been anticipated. Like 5 years ago, the scale of that would not have been imaginable. And the good news is we're way beyond this sort of building awareness. You know, we used, like if you think about it, like 5 years ago, you know, a climate victory would be like, well, we created some awareness.
Right.
You know, and right. that is... Right. Totally not good enough, but fortunately, we are actually way beyond that, you know, and I think that that's really important.
I'm Kai Wright, and you're listening to my 2023 conversation with Liza Featherstone, whose essay in The New Republic argued the case against both climate hope and climate despair. More with Liza just ahead.
Hi, I'm Regina, a producer here at Notes from America with Kai Wright. I know, you're loving this episode. I promise I won't hold you long. But I have to ask, have you seen what we're up to on Instagram? That's where we post questions to you that help shape the conversations that we have on this podcast. Plus, it's a great way to keep up with the show. Follow Notes with Kai on Instagram. That's at Notes with Kai. And we'll talk to you there. Thanks for listening.
It's Notes from America. I'm Kai Wright. Welcome back. This week, we are revisiting my 2023 conversation on climate change with writer Liza Featherstone and listeners about how we shake off the paralyzing eco-anxiety that many of us have developed. Here's the rest of the conversation. Liza and I want to hear more of your stories of climate action. So let's start with Wes in New Hampshire. Wes, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me, Kai.
Thank you for calling. Do you have a climate victory to share?
Well, I'd like to hope it's a victory.
Okay, good enough.
I spent 35 plus years teaching environmental science, and I started an energy program that trained students for careers in energy efficiency. And I saw what you're talking about firsthand from many students who went from either not understanding or denial to throwing their hands up in the air. And to me, I've always felt better about things when I could take responsibility for myself. So that's what I've tried to teach. I wrote a book called Warm and Cool Homes about five net zero houses that heat, cool, and electrify for less than $500 a year in New Hampshire. And made a series of videos which basically show people how they can do some or all of these things to their houses. And take responsibility for their own actions. And
okay.
One of the things in writing the book I found was that all of the people I interviewed who had houses like this felt really proud that they were doing something positive. And a lot of times people think, well, I can't solve the problem, so there's nothing I can do. And what I'm trying to point out to people is there is something you could do by taking responsibility for yourself and the carbon you do or don't emit.
Okay.
And I go around to schools and libraries and speak about this.
I'm going to stop you there, Wes, just for time, because we got a bunch of callers. But thank you for that contribution. Let's go to Lawrence in Chicago. Lawrence, welcome to the show.
Hey. Well, thank you very much, my friend. And I appreciate your time. I just want to first say, if I may, very briefly, I want to thank Liza and Ricky for their contributions to this thought, effort, and where we go. On one hand, as a 65-year-old man, I apologize that my generation didn't do enough early to bring this, you know, to a head, such that with climate change occurring rapidly, we would give the new generation an opportunity to be at the seat of the table to change this paradigm. That being said, victories, you know, in my ward in Chicago, I'm in Berwyn, you know, we recently were declared a natural disaster based on rain and flooding. And one of the things I've been encouraging our people to do is plant more trees and vegetation to absorb the water runoff. That being said, you know, that is a victory. Subsequently, you know, on the carbon footprint, you know, I've been studying my own home to learn how to naturally ventilate the house, even with, you know, 108 degree heat index, to still be comfortable without using air conditioning. And then the other thing, as a architect for the federal government, one of the things that I've been concerned with, my friend, is that the models to reduce energy footprint are outdated. You know, they're 4, 5, maybe even 10 years old. And that has got to change. You know, the data, as we're occurring right now, is very at a critical level, if you will. I'll say it that way. And we're not modeling that when we try to reduce footprint for energy use
and Lawrence, and consumption stuff. Just because I'm short on time here, just a quick on that last point. So what is there a victory in that that you want to share in terms of fixing that problem?
Well, you know, as an advocate, because, you know, part of it is I think about my grandson and, where the next generation's going. So I keep telling the federal government that the data is outdated, if you will, and we need to update that.
Okay.
And
I'm going to stop you, Lawrence, but in advocating for a change, which I agree, advocacy is itself progress. Let's go to Joyce in Portland. Joyce, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on. There's many things that have been victories here. I'm part of a group that for 50 years have worked to get nuclear power out of this state. We're still working on that and have been successful so far. I was part of a group that planted 10,000 native trees in Oaks Bottom and created what was a landfill into a wilderness area. And personally, in my own home, by taking this 100-year-old house and insulating the walls, putting solar on the roof, I went from using 1,000 gallons of oil a year to heat this house to this year it was 100, and I'm sure I can even do better.
Okay. Go, Joyce. Thank you so much for that contribution. And then one more person we asked to call in this week is Jesse Marquez, who created the Coalition for a Safe Environment in Wilmington, California. And Jesse, welcome to the show. Are you there for me?
Yes, thank you so much for inviting me.
So, Jesse, first off, Wilmington is right in the path of the tropical storm that is bearing down on Southern California right now. I believe you are currently traveling and not in the area, but are you in touch with people back there? How are people feeling and preparing in Wilmington?
Actually, I arrived last night, so I'm back in town. Not a problem.
Okay, are you safe?
And just to clarify, Wilmington is a community within the city of Los Angeles.
Gotcha.
So we are one of the harbor coastal communities, and the Port of Los Angeles is physically located and borders Wilmington.
All right. And how are things right now? What are you concerned about or are ready for the community?
Well, on the good side, in 2018, our organization received a grant to prepare a Wilmington Emergency Preparedness Plan, which was finished in 2020. So in preparing a plan, it addresses all aspects of potential disasters, natural disasters, you know, industrial disasters, climate change impacts, so that we have had a campaign now for a couple of years in sharing the information that we've learned, sharing how to prepare, sharing how to address these things once they occur, how to network with other people. And by having this document available, all this outreach has worked with our community in understanding what they needed to do. And I'm happy to say that, yes, residents paid attention. Yes, they've been listening to the news, and that they were preparing for the tropical storm, even doing simple things like taking down a canopy in the backyard, your umbrella with a table and where you have your little breakfasts in the morning, you know, stocking up on extra water. But then we also brought out to them, well, when power goes out, you have to be prepared with power. So make sure you have flashlights, backup batteries for the flashlights. If you have a heater that's electric, then you might need to make sure that there's enough power for that. If you don't have electricity, then, you know,
There's all kinds of things that folks had to do, and they did them. And so that we're at a climate victory story from you there, even as disaster comes at you. Wilmington is is right by the Port of Los Angeles, as you pointed out. And, you know, it's surrounded by refineries, by major freeways and other environmental hazards. The community is overwhelmingly Latino. And part of why we wanted to talk to you is that over the past 20 years, you and your neighbors have been effectively organizing on behalf of environmental justice for your community. And I wanted to bring that into the conversation. And I know in particular, one of the projects that caught our attention was the Wilmington Weather Station. Can you describe what that is and why you would consider it a victory?
Well, remember, I just mentioned the Wilmington Emergency Preparedness Plan. In the process of researching that, we realized that our community needed to have access to information, like in real time, as it's happening now. But what happens if the radio stations go out? I mean, the TV stations, radio stations go out. Does the community have any other resource to go to? Mm-hmm. Well, we do. We have our own weather station in our office. We have backup power, so we don't need to be on the grid. So we will always know what is available here. Even our weather station is connected to the website and connected to the internet. We even have backup power to the internet so that, you know, we can keep on ticking as long as possible. But from the weather, we also realized when we were putting it together, we wanted to have a website, but no one ever goes to a weather station website. Okay. So we made it a web. We needed to make sure that we had things that people needed to know. And that's where climate change also came into it, and natural disasters. So we have links. So if we're talking about tropical storms, there's a tropical storm link. There's a hurricane link. There's an earthquake link. And so we have all these resources there on our website and in our station that people, students, in fact, even a teacher told us one time when she looked at our agenda of what links we were having, you don't have anything for teachers and students. So then we had to go back. And we found 9 more links for teachers and students, and we added that to our weather station. Mm-hmm. But we also had another little community science victory in terms of research. We kind of wondered, well, what is the average temperature of Wilmington? What's the average temperature of Los Angeles? What's the average temperature of California? What's the average temperature of the United States? And then when we got the numbers, we had fell into a little state of shock because it showed that Wilmington's temperature was higher. Now, how can Wilmington's temperature be higher? We're by right by the ocean. We're by the coast. You know, winds blow in. But then we realize the industries around us. On three corners of Wilmington's border, we have a refinery. On the south end, we have the Port of L.A. and Port of Long Beach. On the northwest, we have the sanitation department there. Well, we discovered that we are an example of a heat island effect, which means all these industries generate more heat in your community, so your temperature is higher. Yeah. So when we're talking about climate change and increasing heat, then our community is going to suffer more because we are already above average on what our heat impacts. But then heat impacts not only affect us in terms of public health, the dangers, because we have four refineries in Wilmington. Everyone has exploded anywhere from 2 to 5 times in the last 20 years.
Exploded as in had caught fire.
Caught fire and exploded. When I was 16, I lived in Wilmington on the border of Carson. City of Carson had an oil refinery there. And at 5 p.m. that afternoon, there was an explosion. Mama just called us kids to come and have dinner. As we were running down the hallway to get to the dinner table, we all fell because of that shockwave from the earthquake. Mom and Dad said, hurry up, let's go in the car. We got to leave because we're not going to stay there to see what's going to happen. Go grab Grandma next door. We started getting our car. A second one exploded. Now we were trapped. We couldn't get in our cars. We're going to hold hands, run to the corner, and keep on running for the next 7-8 blocks to get to our auntie's house. But then a third one exploded, larger than the others. We had to run to the backyard. My father yells at me to help my three brothers over the back wall fence. My dad was helping my grandmother, my mother, who was also 7 months pregnant, over that fence. I jump over as the last person. I get ready to run away. I hear a woman's voice. Boy, please turn around. Boy, please turn around. I turn around. There's this blonde woman holding a baby in her hand. The baby's blanket was burned. Baby's face was burned. She threw the baby over the wall like a football. I caught the baby, and she yells at me, please run as fast as you can. Don't turn around. Save my baby's life. And there is no hospital in Wilmington. I eventually ran to a clinic in Wilmington.
Jesse, I'm gonna have to cut this dramatic story short because we're running out of time. But because I know that is your origin story as an environmental justice activist. Can you, in 60 seconds or so, give me? I mean, because a story like that reflects just how hard it is to have optimism in the face of environmental injustice in particular, the equity questions in particular. What is your takeaway for people who care about that issue, about how we stay not fatalist? And again, I got about 60 seconds for you here.
Okay, you do what we did. We thought, what could we possibly do? An emergency preparedness plan was the solution. We needed to understand the dangers. We needed to know what were the recommendations for each one. We prepared charts, posters, handouts, so that our community would be aware of what they could do. Then we got involved in public policy, where we supported AB 32 in 2006, the Global Warming Solutions Act. Then we became part of the advisory committee. And as part of the advisory committee, I made a recommendation that came as a result of our China shipping lawsuit that all ports should plug into electric shore power.
I will have to stop you with those examples, Jesse. I appreciate it. But the point is political action. And that is an excellent segue for final thoughts from you, Liza, because a lot of your work is in electoral politics. And so from a perspective of political action here, as we close the show, what fatalism in that category? That seems like a place where I feel quite fatal in terms of the inability to make elected officials care.
Yeah. Well, I think that is actually changing. It was certainly conventional wisdom for a long time among Democratic operatives, even among further left people, that, you know, you can't really make elected officials care about climate issues because voters don't care enough, mm-hmm. was the kind of conventional wisdom. I was just looking at some polling going back for the last 11 months when people say, what is the most important issue to you? People who voted for Joe Biden in 2020, for the last 11 months, climate has been their most important issue. For these past 11 months.
Wow.
I don't think this has ever happened before. And it seems like a very good opportunity to build on all the kinds of victories we've been discussing, because if this is really... given this is the most salient issue to Democratic voters right now, more than inflation,
wow,
like more than all the things that we believe are more important than, to people. So I think that, you know, this is a lot to build on, and the politicians are going to start caring because the voters are going to vote on this issue.
We got to leave it there. Liza Featherstone's essay in The New Republic is titled The Case Against Both Climate Hope and Climate Despair. We'll put a link in the episode description for the podcast drop of this episode. Liza, thanks so much for this time.
Thank you. What an honor.
And thanks to everyone who called in. You can keep talking to us at notesfromamerica.org. Just look for the green record button and leave us a voicemail. I'm Kai Wright, and I will talk to you here next week.